After nearly 2 years of keeping a low profile, Lucas was ready to enter the public spotlight again in 1986. As Lucasfilm CEO Doug Norby continued paring away at employees and reorganizing divisions inside the company, and with overhead rumored to be approaching $20 million per year, the media and business analysts wondered aloud whether Lucas was getting back into films because he needed the money. The appeal of Mr. Lucas's principal stock in trade, the Star Wars saga, appears to be waning, wrote Michael Sipley in the Wall Street Journal. Star Wars fans, it was argued, had moved on. Toy sales continued to plunge, and even Marvel Comics was preparing to wrap up its monthly Star Wars comic after 9 years. Norby's pruning and rearranging, while unpopular, had actually done much to steady Lucasfilm. With merchandising receipts down, however, ILM would have to step up as the most reliable source of revenue. Over the past year, the effects shop had indeed taken on more and more outside work, producing effects for The Goonies, Explorers, Back to the Future, and even the opening credit sequence for Out of Africa. At the Academy Awards in March, ILM would win yet another Oscar, this time for the special effects for American Graffiti actor, now director, Ron Howard's Cocoon. And yet, even as ILM expanded its work, Lucas would gripe about the company's becoming complacent. A lot of wild, rebellious enthusiasm seems to be paling a bit, for better and for worse, Lucas told Time. While it's reassuring to see the company becoming more stable and professional, it's a challenge to keep things fresh. Inside Lucasfilm, everyone seemed certain Lucas had another big project in development, another game-changing franchise like Star Wars or the Indiana Jones films. I think George will search his instincts for something new, said one employee, while another noted proudly that Lucas has this terrific instinct for popular taste. I'm sure he's got something completely different up his sleeve. He didn't. But what he did have was plenty of old friends whose work he respected, whose company he enjoyed, and for whom he was more than happy to act as a producer. And for Lucas, that was usually more than enough. The resulting films would meet with only varying degrees of critical and popular enthusiasm. One would even be considered among the worst films of all time. But Lucas never regretted making any of them, or putting them out under the Lucasfilm imprint. The company is designed so I don't have to make commercially profitable movies, Lucas explained patiently. Your bottom line assumption has to be that every movie loses money. They don't, of course, but you go on that assumption. It's like baseball. You don't always get into the World Series, but you go on playing. One collaborator Lucas liked a great deal was Jim Henson, with whom he had remained friendly since working together with him to develop Yoda for The Empire Strikes Back. Following the lukewarm reception of his groundbreaking 1982 film, The Dark Crystal, Henson was looking for a big-name producer for his next film, the fantasy fairy tale, Labyrinth. Jim and I both wanted to work with each other, and that was a movie nobody wanted, Lucas said later. While the vision for the film was entirely Henson's, the script remained problematic, with several writers, including Dennis Lee, Laura Phillips, Terry Jones, Elaine May, and Henson himself, unable to crack the structure of the story. Lucas offered to tinker with it too. I'm strong with script and editing, Lucas remarked. One contribution I could make to Labyrinth was to keep the script focused. It's a real trick to keep a script focused. After Lucas sat through 2 days of story meetings at Parkhouse with Henson and his creative consultant, Larry Merkin, one had to wonder how much help he really was. Merkin recalled Lucas taking out a clipboard and drawing 3 or 4 concentric circles and tracing a line through them as he explained the main character's journey through the labyrinth. Lucas was a really lovely, unassuming guy, said Merkin, but I don't remember it leading to anything very helpful to the writer. More memorable, at least to Merkin's mind, was their lunch at a local restaurant, where Lucas was joined by Linda Ronstadt, who turned every head as she entered the dining area. Lucas enjoyed working with Henson and took great pleasure in arranging for Darth Vader to show up on the first day of filming at Elstree to present Jim with a good luck card. Both he and Lucas would need it. Labyrinth bombed with audiences almost immediately upon its release in June 1986, earning only $12 million off its budget of $25 million. Henson took it hard. Lucas didn't. "It's disappointing when something doesn't work, but it's part of the game," he told the Los Angeles Times. "You win some, you lose some." Lucas's next production, which opened a mere 6 weeks later, would fare just as badly. At first blush, Howard the Duck seemed like an ideal project for Lucas. It was based on a comic book he loved, and Howard's co-creator, writer Steve Gerber, was just the kind of defiantly independent artist Lucas admired. Shortly after completing American Graffiti, in fact, Lucas had pressed the issues of the Howard the Duck comic into the hands of Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, telling them they were very funny and might be worth turning into a movie. Hike and Katz had eventually produced a script that they then shopped around Hollywood for nearly a decade, with no takers except Universal, which promised to back it on the condition they bring in Lucas as executive producer. Once again, Lucas would permit his name to be used as a favor to friends. And once again, it would cost him. Production of Howard the Duck was a disaster from the beginning, and the biggest problem was Howard himself. After Hike and Katz had unsuccessfully pushed for an animated version of the film, Lucas suggested instead that they handle Howard as a special effect and put him in the hands of ILM. Unfortunately, ILM treated Howard as little more than a complicated duck costume, cramming one of seven actors inside the suit, usually the 3'4" Ed Gale, who could barely see, fell over constantly, and had to be carried from set to set. The experience was a bad one, too, for Hike and Katz, both of whom felt they'd been marginalized on their own film. Borrowing a page from Lucas's playbook, they left for Hawaii the week their film opened in August 1986, which meant they weren't around to see the disastrous reviews. The headlines practically wrote themselves. "Howard the Duck lays an egg," snickered the Washington Post, while the New York Times called the film a foul brew. And those were the kind reviews. Lucas thought the film had never been given a chance. The movie's promotional materials had prominently played up his involvement. His name was above the title on the first movie posters, which Lucas believed had caused critics to judge it unfairly. Still, Lucas tried to remain upbeat. "If I had to do it over, I'd do it again," he said a year later. "Look, making movies is like a sporting event. Playing the game is the best part. You put all your effort into it, and sometimes you'll be successful. Sometimes the public won't connect." Executives at Universal weren't nearly as understanding. Two production heads nearly came to blows in a heated argument over who was to blame for greenlighting the film. Interestingly, Lucas's most successful film for the year was one that didn't play in traditional movie theaters at all, and came out of a job offer that Lucas never even accepted. In 1984, the Walt Disney Company, on the hunt for fresh blood to re-energize its brand, had approached Lucas about taking over as head of production. Lucas, a lifelong Disney fan, was flattered but refused. He had his own company to manage, after all, and wasn't looking for the kinds of headaches and drama currently rocking Disney's board of directors, which had barely managed to survive a hostile takeover by financier Saul Steinberg. Still, Lucas had advised Disney's new majority stockholder, the billionaire Bass family of Texas, on their purchase of 25% of the company, and strongly endorsed the selection of Michael Eisner, his go-getter ally at Paramount, as an ideal CEO. Once Eisner was in place, he immediately reached out to Lucas and Spielberg about developing attractions based on either Star Wars or Indiana Jones for the Disney theme parks. Spielberg declined, preferring to concentrate on more adult film content. He currently had The Color Purple and Empire of the Sun in the pipeline. But Lucas was thrilled at the idea of having the opportunity to play in the Disney Kingdom, which had so inspired him as a boy. While always skeptical of studios, for Disney, he would make an exception. In February 1985, At a Disney shareholder meeting in Anaheim with 6,000 excited shareholders in attendance, Disney and Lucasfilm formally announced an agreement under which Lucasfilm would develop several attractions for the Disney parks, including a new ride based on Star Wars. The ride, called Star Tours, would use military-grade flight simulators to give riders the sensation of flying through the Star Wars universe, even putting them in the middle of an ILM-produced dogfight with TIE fighters and an assault on the Death Star. At 4.5 minutes long, it was ILM's longest visual effects sequence to date. When the ride opened in January 1987, Lucas was at Disneyland with Eisner to cut the ribbon, both of them waving enthusiastically at record crowds that would keep the ride running at capacity for the next 68 hours straight. "I've always felt that there's only one first-class amusement park operation, and this is it," said Lucas appreciatively. "When I did something, I've always wanted to make sure it was done right. This is the only place in the world like that." While the ride was the high-profile attraction, Lucas and Eisner were trying to keep under wraps their other ambitious project for the parks, a 3D movie called Captain EO, which would feature another A-lister Disney had recently signed, pop megastar Michael Jackson, still enjoying his post-thriller glow of invincibility. Disney, looking to add some zip to its lineup of in-park films, pitched Lucas and Jackson several ideas during a Valentine's Day meeting with Disney Imagineers in 1985. "We were asked to come up with some concepts to go with three elements," said Imagineer Rick Rothschild. The elements were George Lucas, Michael Jackson, and 3D. Both Lucas and Jackson preferred a story treatment called The Intergalactic Music Man, in which Jackson's character would arrive on a cold and passionless planet where he would convince an evil queen, through song and dance, that things are better with warmth and color. But while Lucas had agreed to serve as executive producer for the film, he had no intention of taking on the day-to-day chores of directing it. Jackson was hoping Lucas could persuade Steven Spielberg to take the job, but with Spielberg booked, Lucas brought in an old acquaintance he promised Jackson and Eisner they'd be happy with, Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola's first directive changed the title to Captain EO, an allusion to Eos, the Greek goddess of dawn or light, a decision that met with no objection from Lucas, Jackson, or Disney's hand-picked line producer and screenwriter for the project, Rusty Lemorand. Coppola began filming at Laird Studios in Culver City in June 1985 and completed work in August. A quick shoot, certainly, but not as hassle-free as Lucas had promised. Coppola, while fascinated with the much-improved 3D process, which involved two cameras filming simultaneously at slightly different angles, had often struggled to figure out just the right lighting. Jackson held his song and dance routines close to the vest, refusing to show Coppola what he'd be doing until practically the day the sequence was shot, and Lucas didn't make things any easier, dropping in unannounced and insisting on changes that were either technically difficult or expensive to shoot, even scrapping all the footage that had already been shot using the model spaceships. Harrison Ellenshaw, Disney's special effects supervisor, thought Lucas was somewhat distracted by other projects, namely completion of Skywalker Ranch, so he could never give Captain EO or any of the other things full attention, said Ellenshaw. "So it's kind of like having Michelangelo come by every other day for half an hour and telling you, 'If I had the time, I'd do the Sistine Chapel, but since I don't, let me tell you what you need to do.' And then he'd wait 2 days, and then he comes by and says, 'You didn't do it right. Do this, do that.' Everything was constantly in flux." Captain EO premiered at Disneyland and Walt Disney World in September 1986. Lucas attended the Disneyland premiere, cutting the ribbon in front of nearly 2,000 invited guests. Both parks had rebuilt or refitted existing theaters to accommodate the film and all its incorporated special effects. The theater itself, as Lucas would always argue, was a critical part of the experience. At Disneyland, the film played in the 700-seat Magic Eye Theater, which had been equipped with flashing lights, fog machines, and concussive audio that pulsed and huffed and throbbed in perfect sync with the action on screen, making the movie immersive entertainment. Lemoran would remark that the film wasn't a movie, it was a feely. Clocking in at a fast-paced 17 minutes, the film boasted a price tag of more than $20 million, nearly twice what Lucas had spent on Star Wars, making it one of the most expensive films on a per-minute basis ever produced. Disney was delighted with the film. It would play for more than a decade, and then, after Jackson's death in 2009, returned for another five-year run to tens of millions of parkgoers, making it one of Lucas's most widely seen films. Movie critics may have tried to argue that Captain EO wasn't a great film. It's only the fourth best film at Epcot, insisted Richard Corliss. But Disney patrons didn't care. Most would pay it at least one obligatory visit during a trip to the park, while hardcore fans would sit through it repeatedly. Still, critic Charles Solomon, writing in the Los Angeles Times, lamented that, given the caliber of the talent involved, audiences were entitled to something more than the most elaborate rock video in history. Of course, no one expects an amusement park diversion to be Gone with the Wind, wrote Solomon wearily. But given that list of credits and the film's lavish budget, audiences have a right to expect more than empty flash. Speaking of films, would there be more installments of Star Wars? It was a question that would continue to be lobbed at Lucas wherever he went, shouted at him across hotel lobbies, or tacked on to the end of even the briefest of interviews. This was particularly true in 1987, as fans and media alike marked the 10th anniversary of the release of the first Star Wars. Lucas was surprised by the fuss. While all three Star Wars films had taken in $1.4 billion at the box office, and another $2.6 billion in merchandising, the blush was clearly off the rose. Sales of Star Wars-related merchandise had virtually petered out. The droids and Ewok cartoons had already faded from Saturday morning television. Although all three films had fared well on videocassette, the premiere of Star Wars on network TV in 1984 didn't even win its time slot, losing out to the trashy miniseries Lace on ABC. Lucas was surprised then when the science fiction magazine Starlog asked to work with Lucasfilm to host the first ever Star Wars convention at the Stouffer Concourse Hotel in Los Angeles in May 1987. More than 9,000 fans, many dressed in character, thronged the hotel, paying $18 for 3 days of events and the opportunity to buy merchandise and memorabilia, greeting one another with "May the Force be with you." Lucas stunned the crowd by making an appearance on the stage in the Grand Ballroom on the last evening of the convention, strolling out to John Williams's music and thunderous applause. "Oh, I thought there were only 7 of you here," he joked, as he prepared to take questions from the audience. And to the inevitable question, Lucas would only defect cryptically, giving different answers to different interviewers. "I'm kicking it around in my head," he told the New York Times. "I keep milling the story around to make it more interesting to myself." In the Los Angeles Times, he struck a less optimistic tone, saying, "I haven't really thought about Star Wars. I mean, I think about it from time to time, but it will take a lot of ruminating before I can come up with the energy to do 3 more." But in the Wall Street Journal, Lucas was more encouraging. "Right now, there are too many other things I'm more interested in," he said. "But there will be more. It's just a matter of when." Among those other things was his continuing relationship with Linda Ronstadt. While he and Ronstadt still managed to keep from being photographed together in public, she continued to visit Lucas regularly at his home in San Anselmo or at the ranch. Friends were surprised the relationship had lasted this long. "Linda does have a roving eye," said music producer Peter Asher, "and she does not want to settle down." And yet Ronstadt was genuinely smitten. She had recently rented property in Northern California so she could be closer to Lucas and playfully carried around an Empire Strikes Back lunchbox. Lucas, too, seemed willing to become more adventurous for her. In addition to the dance and guitar lessons, he had even tried, for a couple of months anyway, to develop a hipper look by ditching his glasses for contacts and shaving off his trademark beard. Even as Lucas groused to the press that he had to work hard at having a private life, rumors continued to fly about their relationship status. There was even speculation in the gossip magazines that the two of them had gotten married. They hadn't, but they had quietly gotten engaged. Ring on the finger and all, as Ronstadt put it. More and more, Ronstadt could be found spending time at Skywalker Ranch, riding horses across the pristine countryside. And when the time came to record her 1987 album of traditional Mexican folk songs, Canciones de mi Padre, she chose to use Skywalker's sound facilities. Lucas had even dreamily suggested building them a honeymoon cottage on the Grady Ranch property adjacent to the Skywalker compound, a proposal that eventually bogged down in the continuing zoning disputes with Marin County neighbors. More publicly, Lucas had two films in production, both of which were much closer to his heart and to his own interests than any of the movies he'd produced over the past 2 years. During production on Captain EO, Coppola had mentioned to Lucas that he was still hoping to make a film he'd had on the back burner for years, a biopic about automobile designer and businessman Preston Tucker, Coppola, whose own father had invested in Tucker's car company in the 1940s, had purchased the rights to Tucker's story in 1976 and envisioned filming it as a sort of Brechtian musical in which Tucker would be the main story, but would also incorporate the lives of Henry Ford and Thomas Edison as part of a larger American fable. Coppola had even managed to get Leonard Bernstein to agree to write the music when, the source of Coppola's continued heartache, the bottom had dropped out of Zoetrope. Coppola, looking for a backer, said he was embarrassed and shy about approaching Lucas for support. It was a role reversal, like going to a very successful and busy younger brother, said Coppola. I didn't want George to feel I was intruding, trying to capitalize on his success. But Lucas reassured his old mentor that the request wasn't a big drama, reminding him that he had relied on Coppola's financial support for American Graffiti. Plus, Lucas loved the story, calling it the best project Francis had ever been involved with. Indeed, in addition to its being about cars, always a subject Lucas loved, Lucas could relate to Tucker's story, in which a maverick designer bucks the system to create a new kind of car in line with his own unique vision. It's about how you take a dream and carry it through to reality and what you're up against, explained Lucas. The people in it come up with interesting, creative ideas that are important and relevant to the world we live in, but they're not listened to, and the ideas are stifled from the top. That sounds like the business both Francis and I are in. But Tucker's downfall, in which he lost nearly everything, more closely paralleled Coppola's own adventures in movie making. It was no wonder both Lucas and Coppola were taking the project so personally. Lucas agreed to put up the $24 million budget and even managed to squeeze additional funding and a distribution agreement out of Paramount, leveraging the studio's desire to lock down Coppola for a third Godfather film. But to Coppola's quiet disappointment, Lucas, invoking his rights as producer, took over much of the project. George's fortunes were rising just as mine were falling, said Coppola. So it created a dramatic situation in that the person that had always been the sponsor of things was no longer able to do so. To write the screenplay, Lucas brought in Arnold Schulman, a respected film writer who had recently delivered the screenplay for the film adaptation of A Chorus Line. Schulman nearly resisted the offer, telling Lucas he didn't want to write a movie about cars. This film is not about cars, Lucas told him. It's about Francis. Lucas directed Schulman to write a script that was upbeat and entertaining, not intellectual and messagey. I wanted to make it an uplifting experience that showed some of the problems in corporate America, and Francis didn't resist, said Lucas. Francis can get so esoteric it can be hard for an audience to relate to him. Tucker, The Man and His Dream, opened in August 1988 to generally positive reviews. The best thing Mr. Coppola has done in years, wrote Janet Maslin, but a tepid audience response, earning a little less than its $24 million budget, which made it officially a flop. Holding court with reporters in the weeks leading up to the film's release, Coppola carelessly went into pre-release damage control mode, telling the New York Times reporter that he had forfeited control of the movie to Lucas. "I think it's a good movie," Coppola conceded. "It's eccentric, a little wacky, like the Tucker Carr, but it's not the movie I would have made at the height of my power." Lucas couldn't believe Coppola's colossal gall and immediately went on the record with a San Francisco reporter to set things straight, at least as he saw it. "The truth of it is, Francis and I worked on the movie together, and he made the movie he wanted to make. Who knows what it'd have been if he made the movie on his own," said Lucas. Then, in his parting shot, took a scathing swipe at Coppola. "And who knows what it would have been if he'd made it at the height of his powers, which was 5 or 6 years ago." It was yet one more bump in their always tumultuous, complicated fraternal relationship. Although his friendship with Coppola was unlike any between Lucas and his other fellow filmmakers, he would have a genuinely warm and decidedly non-fractious relationship with Ron Howard, for instance, his hand-picked director for the other film he had in production in 1987, the Tolkien-tinged fairy tale Willow, a project Lucas had been mulling over since the earliest drafts of Star Wars. Howard, on a hot streak following the hits Splash and Cocoon, had sealed his deal for Willow on a handshake with Lucas in 1985, when the film was still scarcely more than a few pages in Lucas's notebooks. "Let's just both commit to this," Lucas said earnestly. At Howard's suggestion, Lucas hired Bob Dolman, who had written an unsuccessful TV pilot for Howard, but had also penned episodes of SCTV and WKRP in Cincinnati, which Lucas admired. Dolman was dispatched to Skywalker Ranch to spend several days with Lucas and Howard in story conferences, always one of Lucas's favorite parts of the process, as he could talk through plots and characters, then hand them off to a screenwriter without ever having to bleed on the page himself. With his story for Willow, Lucas had distilled all the elements he loved best from fairy tales, movies, and folklore. There's a bit of Moses, a dash of Lord of the Rings, a nod to the Wizard of Oz, to tell the story of Willow Ufgood, a farmer from a race of small people who finds a full-sized baby and must return her to her own people, whom she is destined to rule as their princess. Along the way, Willow picks up a warrior sidekick, encounters fairies and trolls, and battles an evil queen and dragons. Lucas dug deep into his own work for inspiration as well. He was determined, for example, finally to make a movie with little people as heroes, an idea he had flirted with but then abandoned in Star Wars. And at its heart was a theme Lucas loved. Mr. Average Man rises to the occasion. Dolman worked his way through 7 drafts before he, Howard, and Lucas were finally happy with it. Securing the funding was just as tough. Even with Lucas and Howard attached to the project, fantasy films hadn't fared well over the last few years. Lucas could attest to that, as Labyrinth had been one of those failures. Furthermore, the film had no real stars. It was going to rely on some expensive special effects, and its main character would be a little person, played by Warwick Davis, who had charmed Lucas as Wicket the Ewok. Suffice it to say, wallets weren't exactly flying open at the studios. Lucas's savior, once again, was Alan Ladd, now the CEO of MGM, who agreed to provide half the film's $35 million budget in exchange for theatrical and TV rights. Lucas would provide the other half and retain cable and home video rights. Principal photography on Willow began in New Zealand in April 1987, then circled back through Wales to Elstree, where Lucas had a number of enormous sets sprawled across several sound stages. While Lucas tried to linger unobtrusively on the set, Howard knew that he was being watched closely. Willow was the first original story Lucas had written since Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and Howard understood that he was expected to take good care of the project. "I know he was disappointed in the outcome of Labyrinth and Howard the Duck," recalled Howard. "But those movies weren't his ideas, and the thing he really enjoys most is kind of cooking up his own ideas and really following it through." Howard was trying hard not to blow it. One of Willow's most memorable moments, however, wasn't made on a soundstage, but rather came out of the workrooms of ILM. One sequence in the film called for Willow, an aspiring wizard, to attempt to turn an enchanted goat back into a woman. But the spell goes slightly awry, and the goat changes into an ostrich, then into a tortoise and a tiger, before finally reverting to human form. Supervisor Dennis Murin pondered ways of doing the effect with props and models, then thought better of it, and turned the effects over to the computer department. Starting with establishing shots of each creature, the computer was used to transition seamlessly from one animal to the next in a single shot. It was the first use of computer morphing, or morphing with an F, as Lucas would always spell it. And that wondrous effect alone would be enough to earn ILM yet another Oscar nomination for Best Visual Effects. It would lose to itself again for its work on the groundbreaking Who Framed Roger Rabbit. In the months leading up to the release of Willow, there was speculation that Lucas might have another big franchise on his hands, that Willow Ufgood might become the next Luke Skywalker or Indiana Jones. And for a moment, it seemed that Lucas might have done it. On its release on May 20, 1988, Willow opened up at number one at the box office. But reviews were unkind, and in some cases, brutal, and audiences never really connected with Willow as Lucas had hoped. Janet Maslin, writing in the New York Times, applauded Lucas for trying to stage another high, ambitious fantasy, remarking that the effort has a certain nobility, even when the film itself does not. But many reviewers felt that Lucas was not only recycling fairy tale cliches, but also blatantly ripping off himself, using old tricks and tropes, but not nearly as well as before. A Star Wars without star quality, declared Time, while Newsweek's David Anson called Lucas the great regurgitator. That one stung, and Lucas accused reviewers of trying too hard to be clever. They tell you a little about what a movie is about, and come up with some spiffy little remark. I really didn't give them much concern. That, however, would never be entirely true. Lucas had rather cathartically made a point of naming one of Willow's villains, General Kale, after one of his most thoughtful, but often harshest critics, Pauline Kael. On March 3, 1988, Lucas and Spielberg sat side by side at a table in front of the U.S. State Judiciary Committee, looking vaguely uncomfortable in their suits, like schoolboys who had been forced to dress up for company. The issue at hand was a seemingly mundane one. The Senate, as part of its constitutionally mandated advise and consent role for treaties, was in the midst of considering the Berne Convention, part of an international agreement regarding copyright. But for Lucas, this was no small matter. The treaty formally guaranteed artists the right to claim authorship of their work and, key to Lucas, the ability to object formally to defacement of their work. The practical issue is colorization, Lucas stated in his testimony, referring to the recent move by cable magnate Ted Turner to add color to the old black and white movies shown on his cable networks. But Lucas, who stood at the cutting edge of digital technology, thought the problem went beyond mere colorizing. Current and future technology, he warned, will alter, mutilate, and destroy films and other works of art for future generations. Tomorrow, more advanced technologies will be able to replace actors, Lucas continued, or alter dialogue and change the movement of the actor's lips to match. Ironically, in less than a decade, Lucas would be doing much the same to his own work, as he began tinkering with the first three Star Wars films, amping up special effects, adding dialogue, and slightly modifying a number of key scenes. But Lucas would argue that, as the creator of the movies, he and he alone was entitled to make any changes he deemed fit to his own work. Who better than the person whose hard labor and unique talent created the art to determine what is an appropriate alteration, he argued. The Senate would approve the treaty a year later, providing Lucas and other artists with the protections he sought. But embedded in Lucas's testimony was a charge that could likely be leveled against Lucas by irritated Star Wars fans. People who alter or destroy works of art and our cultural heritage for profit, or as an exercise of power, are barbarians. But would there be more Star Wars? During a lengthy interview with film critic Charles Champlin in the spring of 1988, Lucas mentioned that he had ideas and notes enough for not just three trilogies, but for four. I'm not sure how I could get to all of them in my lifetime, he added, before moving on to other topics. Lucas, who had just turned 44, was reflective and generally upbeat that spring. At the moment, the fates of Willow and Tucker were still unknown. He was thrilled with everything that was happening with the ranch. A small vineyard had recently been planted near the tech building, lending further veracity to its fictitious backstory as an old winery. But he remained frustrated with the continued local opposition to his proposal to move ILM there. Lucas had recently tried to make nice to a group of about 40 neighbors by inviting them over for sandwiches and a tour of the property. But there was still much hand-wringing in the community about the thought of a 300,000-square-foot building going up in the hills, larger than any existing building in the county. I don't have anything against George Lucas, said one Lucas Valley neighbor. He's a nice man. Hey, I liked Walt Disney too, but that doesn't mean I want to live next to Disneyland. In some press accounts, Skywalker Ranch was compared unfavorably with Xanadu, the castle-like retreat in Citizen Kane, and Lucas to the hermit-like Charles Foster Kane. Lucas argued that he wasn't a recluse. He still enjoyed getting out and doing things, but he did value privacy. In 1988, in fact, he and Linda Ronstadt would amicably end their relationship, doing it so quietly that the news didn't even make it into the gossip magazines. Post-breakup, Lucas adopted another daughter, Katie, and in 1993 would adopt a son, Jet. My main focus was really raising my kids, Lucas said later. I knew I couldn't direct and raise these kids at the same time. A director isn't free to go to parent-teacher conferences. So I said, well, I'll be a producer. I can take days off when I need them, and basically focus on raising my kids. Coppola felt that being a father and a family man had changed Lucas for the better. He raised those kids as a mother, really, said Coppola. He wanted to have a family. He saw what my kids meant to me. He realized that that was really, in the end, all you have. The privacy and secrecy surrounding Skywalker continued to intrigue and slightly baffle the media, critics, and even some friends. John Milius thought that Lucas was wasting his energy by focusing on the ranch instead of on filmmaking. Francis really tried to do things with his power, said Milius. He made movies with German filmmaker Wim Wenders, produced The Black Stallion, produced George Lucas. George built Lucasland up there, his own private little duchy, which was producing what? A bunch of pap. Strong words coming from the writer-director of Conan the Barbarian, and not entirely fair. While Lucas had produced several mainstream duds, he'd also helped out, often without credit, arty, underappreciated films like Mishima and, in 1988, Powakatsi, an experimental documentary by filmmaker Godfrey Reggio that throbbed to a score by composer Philip Glass. It was the kind of film that some part of Lucas still aspired to make, like his student films Herbie and the first THX 1138. Powakatsi was something of a tone poem, with images and sound evoking emotional responses from the viewer. Lucas and Coppola served as executive producers, and Lucas helped negotiate a distribution deal with Canon Films. On the flip side of Powakatsi was Don Bluth's animated dinosaur film The Land Before Time, executive produced by both Lucas and Spielberg. It had been Spielberg's idea, explained Lucas, for a Bambi-type adventure about baby dinosaurs, and he wanted me to executive produce it with him. Lucas had initially wanted to do the film without dialogue, similar to the Rite of Spring segment in the Disney film Fantasia, but had lost that argument. This was a kid's movie, not a tone poem. Lucas also involved himself in the editing process, where he and Spielberg suggested that Bluth tone down some of the film's scarier sequences. This from the two who had delighted in human sacrifice and brain-eating in Temple of Doom, an irony that was not lost on Bluth. The Land Before Time would be a smash with audiences and critics, spawning several sequels and a cable television cartoon. The most successful film Lucas had in production in the spring of 1988, however, was a third Indiana Jones film, which both he and Spielberg were hoping would be a return to form after the misfire of the grisly, gloomy Temple of Doom. Lucas had actually finished a treatment for the third film as early as September 1984, while Temple of Doom was still in the theaters. writing an 8-page story outline called Indiana Jones and the Monkey King. This time, Lucas put Indy on the trail of the Fountain of Youth, which brought him in contact with a magical spider monkey who possesses eternal life. It was an odd quest, but Lucas's preferred MacGuffin, the Holy Grail, had been vetoed by Spielberg early on. Steven didn't like it, remembered Lucas. He said, "I just don't get it." But Lucas hadn't been terribly happy with the Monkey King treatment either, and brought in up-and-comer Chris Columbus, who'd written Young Sherlock Holmes and Gremlins, and who would later go on to direct Home Alone and Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, to adapt his story treatment into a screenplay. That script, too, Lucas would shelve. In January 1986, Lucas tried again, this time bringing in writer Minnow Mayus, who had written the screenplay for The Color Purple for Spielberg. There would be no Monkey King in this attempt. Spielberg had figured out the hook needed to make a Grail quest work. "The search for the Father is the search for the Holy Grail," he told Lucas. If Lucas and Mayus could figure out a story in which a Grail quest worked as a metaphor for Indy's own relationship with his father, Spielberg would be happy. But Mayus's final script wasn't quite right either. It would take one more writer, Lethal Weapon's Jeffrey Boehm, to put the script into its final shape. And even Boehm's screenplay would be punched up by playwright Tom Stoppard under the credit Barry Watson. While writing the story, Lucas had envisioned Indy's father as more of a professor, a Laurence Olivier type, an Obi-Wan Kenobi type. But Spielberg had something different in mind. Indiana Jones had been spawned partly by Spielberg's thwarted desire to direct a James Bond film, so in a way, that made James Bond the father of Indiana Jones. It only made sense to Spielberg, then, that Sean Connery, the first and, to his mind, best James Bond, should play Indy's father, Henry. Lucas wasn't so sure. He worried Connery might want to take over a little bit, but left it to Spielberg to corral and manage Connery. He needn't have worried. As it turned out, Lucas found working with Connery to be a fun experience. That could be said for most of the shoot as well. In contrast to their experience on Temple of Doom, both Lucas and Spielberg generally enjoyed the time they spent on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Much of the film was shot at Elstree, which to Lucas now felt practically like home. "We couldn't imagine not shooting at Elstree," said Frank Marshall, who was producing Last Crusade along with his wife Kathleen Kennedy. In the late 1980s, however, Elstree, along with most of the English economy, was in a fragile state and was in danger of being sold for scrap by its owners, Thorn EMI Screen Entertainment. Spielberg made an appearance before Parliament to make the case for the studio's worth, and Lucas tried to purchase the studio himself, but was stiff-armed by Thorn. Their efforts saved half of it, about three stages, while the rest was torn down to make way for a Tesco grocery store. Even the Star Wars stage Lucas and Kurtz had built for The Empire Strikes Back was dismantled and carted off to rival studio Shepperton. The final weeks of shooting were spent back in the United States, primarily in Colorado, where Spielberg would shoot the opening sequence of the film, a 1912 adventure of a Boy Scout-aged Indiana Jones, played by 18-year-old River Phoenix. Like the selection of Connery, casting Phoenix, who'd played Ford's son in The Mosquito Coast 3 years earlier, was a pitch-perfect choice, with the young actor briefly aping Ford's mannerisms and vocal inflections as he was chased over and through a circus train. The sequence was something akin to a comic book secret origins story for the wily archaeologist, explaining his whip, his hat, his fear of snakes, even his chin scar. It also better defined the character to Spielberg's and Ford's liking, while Lucas continued to argue that Indy should be a morally ambiguous soldier of fortune who sold artifacts to finance an exotic lifestyle. Last Crusade's opening sequence at last showed Indy to be a historical activist at heart, committed to preserving relics in a museum where they belonged. Lucas could only shake his head in quiet objection. The argument was lost for good. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade opened on May 24, 1989, and would sprint to the $100 million mark in a record 19 days, on its way to $450 million worldwide by March of 1990. Critics were mostly impressed, as well as largely relieved that Lucas and Spielberg had abandoned the dimness of Temple of Doom for the effervescence of Last Crusade. Peter Travers and Rolling Stone thought the movie worked nearly perfectly, calling it the wildest and wittiest indie of them all. Roger Ebert gave it what he felt was an almost obligatory thumbs up, while the Associated Press thought it was certain to restore the luster of Lucas's golden touch. While Spielberg had tried to end the film on a conclusive note, showing Indy and his father riding off on horseback into the sunset, yes, Sala and Brody were there too, a shot that looked an awful lot like the final moments of THX 1138, critics and fans were already asking if this was really the last they'd see of Indiana Jones. "Probably," Lucas said, "unless I come up with some completely inspired idea. 3, I think, is a pretty nice number." The next question, of course, was whether there would be more Star Wars. "It's still sitting on the shelf," Lucas told a reporter for the Associated Press. "It'll be a few years before I get back to it." "That's the way those things work. I've got to get motivated by ideas and themes and that sort of thing before I can go back and do it." At the moment, however, Lucas wasn't motivated by Star Wars at all. In the 2 years since its release, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, in which Indy and his estranged father had come to an understanding and reconciliation, seemed to be taking on a special resonance. Since the early 1980s, George Lucas Sr. had been struggling with Alzheimer's disease, needing near-constant care and attention. Lucas had seen to it that his father was placed in one of the best nursing homes in Northern California, and when Lucas's mother Dorothy passed away in March 1989, at age 75, only 2 months before the premiere of Last Crusade, Lucas and his sisters tended more and more to their father's needs. While George Jr. and George Sr. had never been entirely at odds, they had long put any differences aside, and with Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, Lucas had seemed to almost subconsciously offer his father both farewells and forgiveness. As filmgoers discovered in Last Crusade's final moments, Indiana Jones, like Lucas, had been named after his own father. When George Sr. passed away in December 1991, Lucas must surely have at last known that he made his father proud. His sister Kate was sure of it. "When my brother made it so big, that was a real thrill for him, of course," she recalled. "It was nice he lived to see that." Such personal associations aside, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade had gotten him interested in Indiana Jones again, though not, as fans might have hoped, in doing another movie. After watching Jones as a teenager in the opening sequence of Last Crusade, Lucas had been struck by the endless storytelling possibilities provided by a young Indy having adventures in the era of Teddy Roosevelt, Amelia Earhart, and Pancho Villa. Recalling how little interest he'd had in his own schooling, Lucas wondered if he might use Indy to make learning fun and engaging. What if he could expand on the prologue from Last Crusade, showing Indy's adventures from childhood on into his early 20s, and have him encounter famous figures from history? It would be a real opportunity, he thought, to educate and inspire, to correct some of the problems of the educational system he believed had failed him as a student. Already Lucas was exploring methods of interactive learning, teaming up with Apple and National Geographic to create an interactive video disc called GTV, a geographic perspective on American history, which contained 40 videos about historic events. The association with MTV was deliberate. GTV's videos were part music video, part schoolhouse rock, part sketch comedy. Also included in the package was a program called Showmaker, like a junior video editing system, declared Lucas happily, with which students could make their own short films using the images and video from the disc. Working with educators, Lucas had been careful to ensure that the content actually reflected approved curriculum, and by March 1990, 18 of San Francisco's middle schools were using GTV in their classrooms. Lucas found the work inspiring. In 1991, he would establish the George Lucas Educational Foundation, GLEF, in an effort to reignite what he saw as a docile and uninspiring education system, a morass, he called it derisively, by providing it with new and exciting technological tools for teaching. Suddenly, The young man who had been bored with school was trying hard to improve them, a paternal instinct that George Lucas Sr. would have approved of. Occasionally in school, you stumble across a teacher that lights your fire and gets you going, and it becomes one of those great moments. It happens once or twice in your life, said Lucas. And I keep thinking, why can't education be as exciting all the time? He would oversee the creation of two more interactive multimedia programs for use in high schools and junior colleges. Life Story, The Race for the Double Helix, created in association with Apple and the Smithsonian, and the environmentally themed Mystery of the Disappearing Ducks, made with the cooperation of Apple and the National Audubon Society. By 1992, nearly 2,300 schools would be using the programs. But Lucas acknowledged that both the hardware and the video discs were expensive enough to make the program cost prohibitive for many schools. As he had with Edit Droid and Pixar, Lucas quickly abandoned the idea of being a manufacturer of the technology. Instead, Gleff would eventually spin off two companies: EdUtopia, an online clearinghouse for education knowledge and best practices, and, in 2013, Lucas Education Research. Lucas's most ambitious educational project, however, would be the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which he would pour much of himself into for nearly 3 years, and which would revive his enthusiasm for filmmaking. From the beginning, it was always Lucas's intention that Young Indiana Jones would end up as another interactive educational tool, with each episode ported over to video disc, where viewers could access hours of additional information at the click of a mouse. When Indiana Jones meets Teddy Roosevelt on a safari, for example, Lucas envisioned the viewer being able to click on any animal seen on screen, which would then access articles on the animal's environment, maps of its habitat, and hours of video footage. Young Indiana started out as a project to teach turn-of-the-century history in the 8th grade for an interactive prototype that I'm developing, Lucas explained to the Los Angeles Times. In 1990, Lucas sat down with Rick McCallum, a German-born producer he'd met several years earlier in London, while poking around the sets of the film Dreamchild. Lucas laid out for McCallum not only his lofty ambitions for the television series — he wanted a show that would both educate and entertain — but also his unorthodox approach to writing, shooting, editing, and producing it. Lucas would write all the basic stories, and he had plenty of historical figures in mind for Indiana Jones to meet, from Louis Armstrong to Albert Schweitzer. But rather than set up a shooting schedule for each individual episode, Lucas wanted McCallum using a stable of talented directors, including Nicholas Rogue and Terry Jones, who would shoot film constantly. The footage would then be shipped to Lucas back at Skywalker Ranch, where he would begin assembling the episodes using, for the first time, Edit Droid. If there were places where he thought an additional scene was necessary, he would ask McCallum to have his director shoot the desired footage, even in the midst of filming another episode. Lucas was essentially treating the series as one long, extended film. And for this reason, Young Indiana Jones was almost constantly in production for nearly 2 years, moving from one exotic location to another, while Lucas edited furiously back at Skywalker. It was a seat-of-the-pants approach to filmmaking, almost a return to the guerrilla style Lucas had used in film school. Lucas loved it. Young Indiana Jones was more than just an educational initiative. For Lucas, it was also something of an experiment in digital filmmaking. While Lucas had, over the past decade, developed and then deployed digital filmmaking technology for others, he had yet to use it at any real length on a project of his own. When the questions inevitably arose about more Star Wars, Lucas would often point out that those films relied heavily on special effects, which made them very expensive. On top of that, to create the worlds Lucas envisioned in his head often far exceeded the capabilities of any soundstage in Hollywood or Elstree. But what if he could create those special effects and those sets digitally? With Young Indiana Jones, he'd start experimenting with the digital technology he had on hand, using the computer to fill out crowd scenes by turning 10 actors into an expensive-looking throng of 200, or creating digital backgrounds rather than using a more time-consuming matte painting. The mere idea of having Lucas involved with an Indiana Jones television series was enough to persuade ABC to provide the bulk of the funding for the project. Even with Lucas's computer technology keeping costs down, each episode would run about $1.6 million. But while Lucas had managed to negotiate an aggressive deal, he didn't have control over everything. For one thing, it would be up to ABC to oversee the promotion of the show, and the network would never seem to know quite what to do with it, promoting it as a big action thing, Lucas complained. After nearly 2 years of writing, filming, editing, and post-production, the pilot episode finally premiered in March 1992, to mostly polite reviews. Critics applauded its noble goals, even as they found it all a bit boring. Writing in the New York Times, the respected critic John J. O'Connor lauded it as a perfectly admirable idea, but thought that the execution was clunky and heavy-handed. Every time a bit of information is plopped into the script, wrote O'Connor, the sound of Mr. Lucas picking up a teacher's blackboard pointer can almost be heard in the background. Still, ABC was happy enough with the pilot to grant Lucas a full season, and then seemed uncertain what to do with the episodes Lucas gave them, cutting the first season short after only 6 episodes. While disappointed with ABC's handling of the project, Lucas was having the time of his life, rarely complaining about the 50 hours he was putting in each week between the writing, editing, and supervision of the digital effects. "I'm only doing this because I want to do it," he insisted. "It gives me a huge advantage because I couldn't care less if the networks don't like it. I've given up my paying job as a movie producer to do this, so I'm doing it out of love." It was the happiest and most engaged he'd been with a project since college. Unfortunately, the labor of love never turned into a ratings bonanza for ABC. Trying to jumpstart viewership late in the second season, Lucas brought in Harrison Ford to take up the hat and fedora again to play a 50-year-old Indy, telling a story of solving a murder alongside Sidney Bechet and Ernest Hemingway as a young man in 1920s Chicago. Ford, looking somewhat the worse for wear under the beard he had grown for shooting The Fugitive, filmed his part in less than a day at his own ranch. And Lucas was intrigued by seeing Ford as a middle-aged Indy living in the 1950s. It was an interesting premise, Lucas thought, for another Indiana Jones movie. This time, however, even Harrison Ford couldn't rescue Indiana Jones. After 2 seasons and 24 episodes, young Indiana Jones quietly faded from TV screens. Still, it had been worth the effort. The show had superb production values. It had multiple Emmy Awards in editing, art direction, and visual effects to prove it. And most critics agreed it was a well-intentioned, good-looking dud. But if young Indiana Jones was a failed experiment as far as creating a television series with a higher calling went, it had been an unqualified success when it came to exploring the possibilities of digital filmmaking. The digital tricks he had learned on young Indiana Jones might, Lucas hinted, even make it possible to do another Star Wars. It had been more than a decade since the great credits fiasco of 1980, when Lucas had quit the Motion Picture Academy in disgust during the squabble over the placement of Irvin Kershner's director's credit. But in 1992, the Academy, perhaps acknowledging that the prodigal son was responsible for some of the biggest movies in film history, was ready to make amends. The board of directors voted to award him the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award, reserved for creative producers whose bodies of work reflect a consistently high quality of motion picture production. It was a distinguished and well-intentioned olive branch from the Academy, and one that Lucas would accept, even if he still refused to become a member of the Academy. On March 30th, Spielberg took the stage at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion to present the award personally, introducing Lucas as his valiant colleague and great and loyal friend. Lucas strolled out on the stage in a black tuxedo, and in heartfelt prepared remarks reminded Hollywood that filmmaking was about more than business deals and executives. "I'd like to thank the Academy members and the Board of Governors for this tremendous honor, not only for myself, but for the thousands of talented men and women, robots and aliens, and others with whom I've been lucky enough to share the creative experience in the last few years. Movies are not made in isolation. It's a group activity. And it's only because of the work, the very hard work, of many actors, writers, directors, producers, creative technicians, thousands of assistants of all kinds, and projectionists that I'm able to stand here and accept this award. I am very, very grateful to them all. The award, a heavy bust of Thalberg mounted on a wooden block, was the only Academy Award George Lucas had ever won. "I'm too popular for that," Lucas would grumble in 2015. "They don't give Academy Awards for popular films." Still, the Thalberg Award was an appropriate honor for Lucas to receive. While introducing Lucas that evening, Spielberg, who had received the Thalberg Award in 1987 and would finally win an Oscar for Best Director in 1994 for Schindler's List, pointed out that Lucas had changed the look and the sound of not only his movies, but everybody else's movies. By 1992, that was certainly the case. Knowing that Lucasfilm could no longer rely on Star Wars merchandising, Lucasfilm president Doug Normby had rolled all the bread and butter divisions of the company, THX, ILM, Lucasfilm's Games, and a few others, into a new division called LucasArts Entertainment Company. And it was LucasArts that was truly changing the look and sound of everyone else's movies. Lucas's THX sound system was rapidly becoming the gold standard in movie sound, and not just in theaters. Electronics companies like Technics were now producing home versions of the system too, giving every home theater owner the opportunity to watch video cassettes with window rattling sound. It's just a desire to present a film as the filmmakers intended it to be seen, heard, and experienced, Lucas explained. But the real advances were being made over at ILM, which seemed to be producing one game-changing effect after another, year after year. In 1989, ILM had created the morphing water pseudopod, a writhing tube of water that could make human faces, for James Cameron's film The Abyss, an effect so spectacular that it practically won the Oscar on its own. Still, competition was ramping up. There were more and more effects companies setting up shop, including some led by former ILMers, like Richard Edlund's Boss Films. That sort of competition had convinced ILM manager Steve Ross that he had to turn ILM into a brand name all its own. And he thought he might have done it with the effects for Terminator 2, with its computer-generated morphing liquid metal Terminator. "I believe people will become interested in seeing an ILM movie as much as they would an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie," said Ross. And sure enough, at the 1992 Oscars, the same ceremony where Lucas received the Thalberg Award, ILM films received all three nominations in the Best Visual Effects category, with Terminator 2 beating out Hook and Backdraft. And then came Jurassic Park. After acquiring Michael Crichton's bestseller about a dinosaur-themed amusement park gone wrong, Spielberg had pondered the best way to create convincing on-screen dinosaurs. Initially, he pushed ILM to consider using a combination of stop-motion, animation, and animatronics, skeptical that computer-generated imagery, CGI, had advanced to the point where it would be convincing. But Dennis Muren, ILM's special effects supervisor, thought they could make it work. "Prove it," said Spielberg. Lucas would never forget the day they did. "We did a test for Steven, and when we put the dinosaurs up on the screen, everyone had tears in their eyes," recalled Lucas. "It was like one of those moments in history, like the invention of the light bulb or the first telephone call. A major gap had been crossed, and things were never going to be the same." With their completely convincing dinosaurs, Muren and his team had fundamentally changed the role of the computer in special effects. It had gone from simply being a tool in filmmaking to being the tool. Spielberg, eyes wide with amazement, could only agree. "There we were, watching our future unfold," he said. Muren, while impressed, was more contemplative. "I don't know where the end of this stuff is," said Muren. "I mean, how real is real?" When Lucas strolled across the stage to collect his Thalberg Award, the in-house orchestra at the Chandler Pavilion had struck up the theme from Raiders of the Lost Ark, not the march from Star Wars, an indication of the trilogy's faded reputation by the early 1990s. It had been nearly a decade since Return of the Jedi, and while Lucas would always be asked if more was coming, The original films were starting to be regarded, if they were regarded at all, through a warm haze of nostalgia reserved for movies like The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, or even American Graffiti. All terrific movies with their own loyal followers, but none with a pervasive pop culture saturation. Star Wars had gone from a sensation to a pleasant, though distant, memory. Or so it seemed. In 1988, Lou Aronica, the head of mass market publishing for Bantam Books, had written Lucas a letter that was part business proposal, part fan letter. Aronica had heard Lucas hem and haw about future Star Wars films and thought it would be a shame if no one ever learned what happened to Luke, Han, and Leia after Return of the Jedi. And he suggested that Bantam could produce a series of books continuing the story where Lucas had left off. "This body of work is too important to popular culture to end with these three movies," wrote Aronica. It had taken a year for Lucas to get back to him, and his response, while encouraging, was unenthusiastic. "No one is going to buy this," Lucas said. But he gave Aronica the licensing and his blessing anyway, as well as a few conditions. Namely, the books had to be post-Jedi. There could be no talk of prequels, since Lucas planned to carve that space out for himself. And there could be no killing off of the existing characters, nor could they bring back any who were already dead. Aronica quickly hired Hugo Award-winning author Timothy Zahn, who was already a huge Star Wars fan. And in 1991, Zahn's first Star Wars novel, Heir to the Empire, slowly but steadily climbed its way to the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Zahn followed Heir to the Empire with two equally successful Star Wars novels in 1992 and 1993. Meanwhile, Dark Horse Comics, flexing its muscles with a Lucasfilm license of its own, produced the six-issue bi-monthly series Dark Empire, which was so successful it would spawn two sequels. Clearly, Star Wars still had a pulse. LucasArts had felt it too, finally releasing several Star Wars-based video games in 1993, the first time Lucas had agreed to let his programmers play in the Star Wars universe. There were Star Wars games for Nintendo and Super Nintendo, new trading cards, and bendable figures. Even the Lucasfilm Fan Club magazine, which had been launched quietly in 1987, was renamed Star Wars Insider. So would there be more Star Wars then? For Lucas, it now seemed to be a matter of having the digital technology available to make the movie look on screen the way he envisioned it in his head. But that would be costly, and Lucas, even after the success of Jurassic Park, still wasn't sure that CGI technology was where he wanted it. "If I were to do them, the prequels, the way I'd done the other Star Wars films, they would be astronomically expensive, over $100 million, he told the Wall Street Journal. "So we have to sort of reinvent the wheel and be able to accomplish them with a reasonable amount of money. It's all sort of dependent on how fast the new technology falls into place, but it's coming along pretty fast now." As to just how fast, Lucas intended to put the technology to the test in a film he'd been trying to make since the early 1970s called Radioland Murders. Conceived at roughly the same time as American Graffiti, it was one of the films he'd dangled before Universal during his initial deal. Lucas wanted Radioland to tap into the same kind of nostalgia for old radio shows that Graffiti had for cruising. But Lucas wanted it played in much broader gestures than Graffiti, citing his own fondness for the Abbott and Costello film Whodunit, in which the comic duo investigated a murder at a radio station. Lucas had passed his story treatment on to Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, and their script had enough traction at Universal for the studio to feel comfortable announcing that the film was in production, with Lucas directing and Kurtz producing. But things fell apart after that, and the project sat in a development dead zone for the next decade. When Lucas finally dusted it off again, he promised Universal that he could shoot the movie inexpensively. He thought for about $10 million, because he intended to use CGI to finish the tops of the partially completed sets and to create digital background mats that would negate the need for elaborate and expensive 1940s-era sets constructed on a soundstage. Universal, while skeptical, agreed, on the condition that Lucas rewrite the script to give it a faster, more modern feel. Ron Howard recommended the team of Jeff Reno and Ron Osborne, who had written and produced the quirky TV series Moonlighting. But even with Reno and Osborne's chatty script in hand, Lucas would pick apart what he considered the best bits from all the varying treatments and push and pull them together into the final script. It was not a good start. Looking for a director with an intentionally comedic touch, Lucas hired English comedian Mel Smith, a veteran of the English TV comedy sketch show Not the 9 o'clock News, and whose only directing experience had been the 1989 dud The Tall Guy. But Lucas had liked that film's slapstick style. "We're more in Benny Hill territory here," complained one critic, and liked Smith personally. Smith would have his work cut out for him from the moment he arrived at Carolco Studios in North Carolina. Most of the sets were only partially finished, with the rest to be filled in later via digital compositing. Smith would squint through the eyepiece of the camera, then ask dryly, "Now tell me what I'm seeing?" Radioland Murders bombed on its release in October 1994, with attendance falling off by a staggering 78% in the second week, and earning back only $1.3 million of its $15 million budget. Reviews were scathing. Most criticized its too fast pacing, an over-reliance on slapstick and sight gags, both of which had been intentional on Lucas's part. But Lucas brushed off the criticism. "It came out almost exactly or even better than I hoped it would come out," he told reporters defiantly. "I like my movies, and I'm always surprised if they do very well or do terribly. But Radioland Murders was inexpensive, and we learned quite a bit." What Lucas had learned was that it was possible to build a world convincingly in the computer. Sets could be completed or constructed entirely. Backgrounds could be dropped in. Skies could even be darkened. "I think we may have reached a level here where we have actually created reality," said Lucas, which, of course, is what we were trying to do all along. So would there be more Star Wars then? This time, Lucas had a definitive answer. "I plan to start work on the screenplays soon."